Good evening. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Bill Hatzman. And I think it's funny sometimes the places you go and the people you meet. Sometimes you meet some interesting characters. And in some of my travels years ago, I had an opportunity to meet Brian, who's going to share some of his story with you tonight. And it gives me great pleasure to bring people like Brian to our stage to share with us this amazing miracle of recovery that happens in AA. And so if you would please join me in giving Brian a warm Tulare County welcome.
My name is Brian, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm actually from North Fork now. Anybody know where that is? Right? Okay. Up there in the mountains. And I about a year ago, I left the Tower District in Fresno. And I wanted to get my family up there in the country and raise some babies country. And I'll tell you, man, that's a good option to have today, especially for a guy like me. And back in the days, that would not have even been on my radar as a possibility. And you'll understand that here in a minute. First of all, I want to say, for any of you people who are doing this deal from a program seat, like you're in some kind of a recovery home or doing some kind of program like that, my hat is off to you, man. And the utmost respect to what you're doing and taking the steps out here to put your life together and build a better you, man, so we got better communities. So thank you for what you're doing. Yeah, you guys rock, man. There's a lot of distractions out here. And so that leads me to my next one. Anybody doing H&I business, hospitals and institutions, anybody beating on the gates of a prison to get in to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to people like me who couldn't get out here to get it, thank you for what you're doing. And you're looking at a fruit of your actions, okay? I am a product of what you do and the message you brought and the room you made available by beating on the prison gate to get in and open a room that I couldn't get to as a convict. I couldn't get to the room unless someone from the outside came in and say, hey, we want to do Alcoholics Anonymous in there. And because of that, I got to get there in 1997 for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of getting to that meeting, my sobriety date is November 9th, 1997. I haven't... Thank you, and that's the testament to, I'd say, the bottom level of desperation. I was so desperate and so broken and so hungry that I came all the way in, and I sat all the way down, and I stayed. Okay, I didn't have to go back out and do more research. I decided to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to die differently than I was going to die. I was on a prison yard doing a 17-year to life sentence, and I was either going to get shot to death by a prison guard, I was going to get stabbed to death by a convict, or I was going to overdose. Other substances are a big part of my story, but I'll tell you right now, I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from the alcoholic disease, and I have that disease. And I heard an old-timer tell me one time, we were in North Carolina speaking at a correction conference together, and he told me, he said that other substances were like condiments to him on the hot dog. He went to get the hot dog, but the condiments made it taste a lot better, you know? So, hey, when I say condiments, that's what I'm talking about, okay? I was a fan of condiments, but I suffer from the alcoholic disease. And I come from a long line of alcoholics, and it wasn't long before I discovered alcohol to change the way that I feel. I mean, I discovered that that's what was happening in hindsight, that I was someone who was trying to change the way that I felt. I had something that was I describe as a poor sense of self. A poor self-image. I felt like at a very young age that I was damaged goods, that God had left a component out of me, that there was something different about me than the other kids, and I was a fraud, man, because I had a lot of fear. I was a sensitive kid. I had a lot of fear, and I overcompensated to try to prove I wasn't afraid. And a lot of the stuff that was happening in my family dynamic was the man-in-the-box thing, you know, where men were supposed to be in control, power was control, violence meant power, you know, and it was this whole conception of who I was to be as a young man. And really, man, I had a lot of fear and couldn't talk about it. And I'm not saying that that's the reason that I'm an alcoholic. I believe in the genetic deal that I got, that I have something different than my wife has, who, you know, is able to drink, you know, one drink and not get drunk. She handles it very differently than I did. But I have this genetic predisposition to alcohol. My life circumstances weren't a problem with me becoming an alcoholic. I had that already. It just kind of put it into the cauldron of heat to maybe bring it out faster, to make it manifest and become visible faster at a young age. So for me, by the time I was 14 years old, I had left home, went to the streets, and I never went back home again. I went out there to prove I didn't need nobody for nothing, and to be a man, cut my own path, and alcohol and other substances, condiments, were a big part of how my disease progressed rapidly. And violence is a big part of my story, too. I had learned that violence was control and that I had to be in control. By the time I was 21 years old, 2 months into my 21st birthday, I had been packing pistols for self-defense, and I used a pistol in a non-self-defense way. I shot and I killed a man, essentially to show him who he was messing with, and it was just kind of the rule on the streets. That's what happened in the game. That was my mitigating my responsibility, but what it was a murder. I murdered a man in 1988, and I lied and said I didn't kill nobody when the police arrested me, and they said, Brian, we know you did it, we just need to know why, because we don't understand, and it's going to change the next thing that happens here. And I said, I didn't kill nobody, and I'll tell you, ever since I started drinking, I was a liar. You know, I had to lie about drinking. I had to lie about the condiments. I had to lie about where I was going. I had to lie about where my money was coming from. I had to lie about, you know, who I was kicking it with. And I was a liar, so it was very natural for me when the pressure was on to resort to that lying. You guys know what I mean? It's like it's that quick. I sobered up for a couple days in my county jail till I learned how to make Pruno. It was probably a week, and I started making, you guys know about that, right? So I started making Pruno, and I was a condiment trafficker. I learned how to move condiments into the county jail. And I went through a murder trial, with my disease progressing. I couldn't face what I had done. I wasn't gonna take, responsibility, much less accountability for the damage that I had caused, what I had actually done, the weight of what I had done. And that was my coping mechanism, was getting loaded, drinking. I was rightly convicted of second-degree murder. It was an appropriate verdict, and I was sentenced to 17 years to life in state prison. And what I knew about lifers only came from my county jail and the guys who were going into prison and coming back out and going back in and coming back out. You know about that? They call it life on the installment plan, the recidivism deal, you know? go to the streets, get sick, come to jail, get healthy, prison, same thing. And what they told me was that lifers didn't get out of prison, that I was going to prison to die. And I accepted that. I had made my bed. It was nobody's fault but mine. And I went into prison to be the best convict I could, to live as long as I could, and to die the convict death, which was shot to death, stabbed to death, or condiment overdose. I did a good job of protecting myself with violence in prison. I went into prison as a young man that fit in the prison system. I was impulsive. I was reactionary. I was filled with anger. I was filled with resentment. I was a perfect convict. I was exactly who you wanted out of your community. Right choice. Absolutely. And I thrived in prison. I did everything I was supposed to do. I spent 1993 in the SHU, security housing unit, did a year in the hole. When I came out, I was worse than when I had went into the SHU, because there's this level of hierarchy with violence that it's the only place it happens, this insane respect that comes with more violence, you know. Like being a murderer was somehow a hierarchical thing, you know. It was more power, more prestige, so to speak. And it took me a while to decide to do something different. And in 1997, a couple things happened to me. My sister brought my niece, Sarah, to visit me, and she was a brand new baby. And this kid had something, man. I had never had a baby in my arms before, you know, and I was holding this baby, and she was this fat, chunky, she looked like she had a rubber band around her elbow and around her wrist, and she was like this, you know, this little balls of fat in her chunky thighs. And she had these perfect little nails. I didn't know babies had fingernails. I thought maybe they grew them later or something. I didn't know. No, I didn't know, man. I had no idea. And her little feet were just, you know, she was amazing, man. She was a little miracle. And women have babies all the time. I don't know what's miraculous about that. But I'll tell you this, man. When I was holding her, I knew a miracle was in my hands. And I had wrestled with God. And I read in the flyer, Spiritual Awakening in 12 Steps, so I'm not going to go too long at this. But I was having a spiritual experience as a guy who knew God from my upbringing, that I was a sinner, I was a sinner, I was a sinner. Now, no one ever told me that I couldn't get right with God. No one ever told me that God didn't have a place for me. But that's the message that this little boy got. You know how we, you know, it's not really reality, but we make our own conclusions as children until we're old enough to kind of make our own decisions and choose what we choose to believe. But man, by the time I was in the system, I was so far gone that I knew there was no get back. And when I committed a murder, in my mind, it was a wrap. I had heard the gates of heaven slam shut on me, and I was done. So when I'm holding this little baby and I'm going, man, you know, if she could speak, she'd rat out God. I knew she came from God. You know, if she, you know, it was like I knew there was something about this kid. So I went back to the yard and I started looking at lifers, and lifers were getting out of prison in one of those three ways. In 1997, you guys have been to the joint? 1997, lifers weren't getting out of the joint, man. What I knew in the level three, which was the lowest prison I could get to, was that lifers were getting shot to death, stabbed to death, or overdosed. And that's what I knew was the reality for me. So I saw nothing different. There was no motivation to do something different to, like, get out of prison. You know what I mean? The performance-based, you know, come to AA to get something different on that end. It wasn't there for me. But what I thought was that if I did something different, that Sarah might have a different legacy to talk about Uncle B than one of those three things. I didn't go to the church house. I went to the one guy who came out of New Folsom with me on the bus, who was a heavy hitter, solid guy, 27 years of life, Steve, and he was sober, man. And he had a light about him that I didn't have. You know, he had a light that was solid and shined in a place of ugliness and darkness. And I went to Steve. And I said, man, this is what I'm going through. This is what I'm thinking about. We had done some time together up in New Folsom, so we had a camaraderie already. It was kind of surviving something where guys were dying. And Steve took me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me to Alcoholics Anonymous because you people who do H&I were in the prison to open up the doors. That's what I mean. Okay? So if you guys weren't there, Steve wouldn't have had that room to take me to. Steve became my sponsor, and I worked the 12 steps. Okay? This was 1997. I came all the way in, and it took. It stuck, man. I ain't had a new sobriety date since. It's the one I got. But what happened was I worked the 12 steps. So I hear a lot of things out here about like meeting makers make it. You gotta have a sponsor, he's got a sponsor, he's got a sponsor. What I had was the only freaking sponsor on the yard that I knew was sober. I didn't do an interview process. I didn't say, hey, do you think we're compatible? You know, it was like, hey man, he's the guy that I had. He was a sober alcoholic, and guess what? That was good enough. That's what it took, okay? So if you guys are hemming and hawing and trying to figure out maybe, maybe not, maybe it's her, maybe it's not, you know what? Pop the clutch, man, and get into the 12 steps. Because the 12 steps are exactly the things that kept me sober. I didn't have a meeting every night of the week to go to. I had one meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every other week. Every other Tuesday. The other Tuesday was the other fellowship. And I'm screwed up enough that I went to the other fellowship too. Because that's how broken and hungry I was. It didn't matter where I got it. I had to sit in a room. Okay? So I didn't have the meeting makers make it deal. I just went every Tuesday that I could get into a room to hang out with people like you who were carrying the message in to a guy like me. So it took. What happened to me was, Steve would not let me make amends by writing letters to mommy and daddy and everyone else that I screwed up in my community. He said, Brian, you're a lifer, man. Your community is this yard. I didn't have nowhere else to go to, but I had caused a lot of damage on my yard. I had caused a lot of pain. I had hurt people. I had disrupted the prison. If that makes any sense, I was a problem. I was one of the problems in the prison, so I had to get right where I was at. And I had to start making amends to people right where I was at, okay? And I did that. And it's not easy. Talk about a place of lack of trust. It's like, give me 5 feet, man. Like, I got to make amends to this guy. He said, hey, you remember? And I'm all, ah, man. He had the inside line. You know, he knew who I had owed amends to. And I had to make it not only right, but make that person as comfortable as I can. I'm a product of restorative justice as well. And it's this concept of making things as right as I can. I can't fix what was done, but I can make it as right as I can. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me. And I became a meditator. I like that you guys pause for a whole minute. Like the longest minute of your life, right? You guys ought to try that talk, you know, what do they call it, active listening, where one person talks, the other listens for 2 minutes without talking, and then switch roles. That's really long, 2 minutes. But I became a meditator, and I want to tell you that I hear a lot of program people, not program like program, but like AA people, like talk about how they can't meditate, and that they just can't make their mind blank. And I don't know whoever said that, where that came from, but that whoever started that make your mind blank thing has caused more harm, man, than I can even tell you. The nature of the mind is not to be blank. The nature of the mind is to think. The best we can do is point it in the direction we want it to go. So as we're thinking about something, we start moving towards it. You know this. You know, this is just cognitive awareness here. It's like what you think about, you start moving towards. That's why we do gratitude lists, man. You want to make a resentment list? Watch how your day goes. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really simple science here. So in meditation, we start thinking about what we want to move towards, whether it's God, whether it's love, whether it's freedom, whether it's light, whatever it is, you know, that's what we think about. Well, I became a meditator probably a year after I got sober because I was so full of anger and frustration that I didn't know what to do. I showed up at an AA meeting and this H&I person was talking, and she's the one who had pushed on me when I first came in, and her name was Patricia. And Patricia had told me, Brian, if you work the 12 steps, you're going to feel better. You got to, you know, she got up on me, man. Like, I'm like, give me some room, man. I'm here. You know, you got to back up and leave me alone for a minute. And I was just checking it out. A year later, I'm full of anger, hostility, and I'm reading the book, and I'm in the room, and I start going off. And in prison, we sat in a circle, and she was across the room from me. She was short, and her feet wouldn't touch the ground. Her legs would do this, and she was short, and long black hair, and she'd roll her head back, and her hair would go back. She'd laugh, and I'm going off, and the convicts are like, man, it's a Jerry Springer show, Brian's, you know, this ain't working, that ain't working, this book's full of this, and da da da, and she starts laughing, and her little feet come up, and she's laughing. And I go, you know what, we know about crosstalk, they taught us how to conduct ourselves in the rooms, but I put her on front street, and I'm all, you know what, yeah, that's funny, you told me, you told me if I worked these 12 steps, I'd feel better. You remember that? And she laughed, and her little feet came up, and her hair rolled back. And she goes, yeah, I did. And you do. You feel hurt better. You feel confusion better. You feel frustration better. And I laughed, too. I laughed because I'm an idiot, man. And here I was all serious. But the reality was I was having feeling issues. And what's my deal all along? I'm an alcoholic who likes to feel good. Man, I'm an alcoholic who likes to feel good. So this stuff was problematic for me. So Steve's got me writing, man, and I started meditating, and I had to, you know, get into this thing where, you know, I signed up to meditate, you know, twice a day for 20 minutes. That's where I started at. And I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these 12 steps. And what I mean is that prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a serious disconnect from God. I've come to define sin as a disconnect from God. You see, when I connect with God, miraculous things happen. And I'm in my pickup truck and someone can cut me off going to work. And I'm on their tail. You know, I'm like, you don't know how good I can drive. I'm a good driver. I've been only driving 7 years now, but I'm really good at it, you know. So I'm going to tailgate them and show them. And then as soon as I think about God, my foot comes off the accelerator. It's like this thing is just linked and there's this string that just pulls my foot back. It changes the next thing that happens for me. Prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never had that thought of God. But today, as a sober alcoholic, I have thoughts of God all day long, and people on my work site don't get hurt because of me. You know? It wasn't all that long ago that people would get hurt because of me. You know? So this thing with God is a solution. When I was in prison, I never once prayed to get out of prison. My only prayer was I knew that there are all kinds of prisons. I knew that there's people committing suicide out here because they're miserable. Misery is everywhere. What I knew is I wanted to know God on every breath. That was my prayer. Let me know God on every breath. I wanted to breathe God. And I had to do some way out stuff in prison to get my mind to like let a lot of stuff go. There was a book I read one time by Pema Chodron, a meditation teacher, and it talked about wishing happiness in the root of happiness. So I sat at the stainless steel table in the day room, and everybody walked through the sally port. I'd hit them, man, I wish you happiness in the root of happiness. I wish you happiness in the root of happiness. I wish you happiness in the root of happiness. Sometimes you'd see my mouth move, and people thought I was just crazy. I fit. It was perfect. No problem, man. Nobody messed with me. But most of the time, it was in my mind. And the trick was, it's easy to do to the people I like or that I love. I want them to have happiness in the root of happiness, right? It's the people that are neutral, that I have no feeling one way or another. If I could go either way, negative or positive, I'll go positive. Sure, I wish you happiness in the root of happiness. And then the people that I really dislike, let's just say they're jerks, okay? If they had happiness in the root of happiness, they wouldn't be jerks, right? So wouldn't I wish that for them? Of course I would. So I would do that day after day after day. And guess what happened? I started feeling different because I'm an alcoholic who likes to feel good. It didn't change nobody walking through the sally port. It changed the way I was looking at it. You guys know Chuck C's new pair of glasses, right? That's me, man. I was changed. I was getting a new pair of glasses as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. What I know today is that my God created me to love people. My problem was disconnect. Art McClellan told me, Brian, you're terminally unique. I was going to kill myself with my uniqueness, looking for how I was different than other people. Okay? This was a sponsor I was working with who told me I was terminally unique. That was my problem ever since I was a little kid. I became a fraud because I was afraid to be who I really am. Alcoholics Anonymous took away that fear, man. What you see is what you get. This is me. And I love you guys. Man, I love you. You program people? I love you and I'm glad you're here. I am glad you're here. I love you guys. We need you. That's my solution today is connect. How do I connect? By not drinking, not picking up no matter what, and loving on people, man. A few basic things. Cleaning the house and working the 12 steps. That's it, man. I worked the 12 steps. That's what I did. And as a byproduct of that, man, they kicked me out of prison. After 22 years. Hey, I was 21 years old when I went to prison, and I came out when I was 43 years old. 22 years and 3 months later, there was no point in keeping me no more. And I didn't win a case in the court. I didn't fall through a loophole. The Board of Parole hearing said, Brian, you've done enough time and enough work that we want you to go out there in our communities. We feel safe with you in our community. I came straight to Fresno. That's a God shot. That's a God thing because I had resigned myself to dying whatever death came. I was so free from the attachment of it, it didn't matter no more. And that's when the door opens, when you're no longer tripping. I came to Fresno, never been to Fresno before in my life, but my wife's a Kerman girl. And she's down here in Fresno, so I come to Fresno and do parole. They sentenced me to life on parole. The judge, I remember clearly, he said, Mr. Fowley, if you ever happen to get out of prison, and I don't believe you will, you will spend the rest of your life on parole. I'm sentencing you to life on parole. And guess what Fresno did? They said, man, 5 years later, you've done an exemplary parole. We're putting you up, man. And guess what Sacramento did? Discharge, man. I got a discharge card in my pocket. Yep. And I got a passport. Ain't gone nowhere, but I got a passport. In case I need to, real quick. And I got to vote, too. Yeah. And so what happened was, man, I came out here and I did 90 meetings in 90 days. And I had sobriety. I was 13 years sober when I got released from prison. And I came to Fresno and I did 90 meetings in 90 days because I was scared to death to not have a foundation. And Alcoholics Anonymous was my foundation. I got plugged in with the men in Fresno, Kurt. Me and Kurt met up there. The guys in Fresno picked me up, and it was like, man, I learned we had a 6:30 in the morning. It was my home group, St. Therese, you know, because I could walk. Because I didn't have a driver's license. I wasn't even in the system. I was 43 years old and had to go get a learner's permit. And I could walk to that meeting. I learned we had nooners, 5:30, and 7 o'clock meetings. And I went to a lot more than 90 meetings in 90 days. And I got plugged in, and I got into service in my community. Went to school, went to work, took a minimum wage job. At 43 years old, I took a minimum wage job. And this guy tells me, man, it's a motorcycle shop on Van Ness in Los Angeles, Chris Rivas V-Twin. He hired me. And I told him exactly where I'd been, how I got there, and how I got out. And he said, man, I want you to be part of our team. And he offered me a job. He said, Brian, I can only pay you $8 an hour. And I got this big grin. He goes, what? I go, man, that's a huge raise. I was making 17 cents an hour. I mean, do the math. What's the percentage on that? And I'm an alcoholic. It took me like 3 months to start getting resentful, man, right? And my wife was telling me, I'll pay you $10 to stay home on my days off, you know, quit going to work. Pay you $10 an hour. And I went to school, man. So what I did was I came out and I did Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to school and I went to work. And I earned a bachelor's degree in criminal justice administration. I know that's crazy, right? With the human services focus, because I love people, right? So I focused on people. And then I went on to my graduate studies, and I'm halfway through a master's degree in peacemaking and conflict studies over at Fresno Pacific. And I'm a peacemaker. I didn't know it. You know, if you'd have looked at me back then, you'd have bet good money that I was going to spend the rest of my life in prison and die in prison. That would have been I would have bet against me, man. But Alcoholics Anonymous, miracles happen, and this transformation happened, and I became the person that God intended me to be. And I learned that I've been a peacemaker for a long time. I mean, when I started becoming a meditator, a sober meditator, I was a peaceful force on the yard. I was a weirdo doing yoga out on the yard, you know what I mean? And I'm tattooed from my neck to the tops of my feet. I mean, I'm not like, you know, some blending in guy. You know, I blended in there. I don't blend in out here. But it's like I was, you know, a peaceful force. And when I came out here and got into restorative justice and mediation, you know, I realized that I'm a peacemaker. And that's what I do in my communities. A few months ago, we started a nonprofit called Community Catharsis Solutions. And we're helping people live better lives. That's what my goal is. I'm an electrician by trade. And by the way, I was telling Bill earlier that I learned that trade in prison. I learned the electrical trade in prison. And now I'm a journeyman electrician licensed by the state of California, making way too much money with a benefits packet and a retirement plan, and guess what my baby's got? Badass insurance. You know what I mean? Hey, and everybody's squared up and taken care of, and it doesn't feed my soul, but it takes care of my family and the Community Catharsis Solutions, the nonprofit stuff, the working with people, feeds my soul. And I gotta have both. I gotta have the balance. I'm a father. I'm 50 years old. I've got a 20-month-old daughter, Madeline Claire, and I've got twin boys that are 5 months old. And I never thought, thank you, man. And I'll tell you, being a father, most awesome experience I've ever. My wife told me, you think you know love. And I said, yeah, I do know love. I know about love, man. I not love, I love people. She says, you think you know. But when Maddie came, Madeline, oh my gosh, she just stole my heart. And it's so different. And being present, like, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be present with that child the way that I am. And that is the most precious gift that I got. There's all kinds of prisons in the world, you guys. There's all kinds of prisons. And you owe it to yourself to figure out where your self-inflicted limitations are. Because guess who made mine? Me. And the strongest prison I was ever in California builds good prisons, you know. I started in San Quentin, Folsom, Solano, Jamestown, and they were all good prisons. But the one in my mind was the strongest. It was what I believed to be true, man. What was happening in my mind was the most powerful force. And when I started putting my mind on becoming a citizen, guess what happened? I'm a citizen. Damn straight, right? That's what happened. I became a citizen. And as we move towards it, you know, we do the next right thing. The 12 steps are the thing that opened every door in my life. Now, those are some incredible doors. You agree?
Yeah.
Right? Like walking out of prison, when you think of the big ones, you know, job, babies, I got to drive here tonight, you know, it's like, I got a motorcycle I get to ride, I live up in the mountains now. It's like every one of those doors, if Alcoholics Anonymous ain't there, the foundation, none of that stuff lasts. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? We lose it. We lose it. So for me, coming all the way in, sitting all the way down and staying is the most important thing. Without AA, I would have never got God. Some people say God's first, AA's second. It may be AA's first. God's, to me, it's like the same deal, man. They called it, what, spiritual kindergarten? Right? I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, start getting spiritually aware. Next thing you know, I'm plugged in. So, I don't know. If anybody wants to talk about meditation or anything else, hit me up after the meeting. But when we seek to, like, get Alcoholics Anonymous, we ain't kicking it with the people who are still drinking, right? We're kicking it with the successful alcoholics who are no longer drinking, right?
Yeah.
When you got a plumbing problem, do you call the electrician?
No.
Heck no. If you want to learn how to meditate, who are you talking to? The people who can't do it? The people who say you got to make your mind blank and I can't do it, so I'm not doing it? No, talk to a monk, man. I mean, I talk to monks, meditation teachers regularly. Regularly. So if you're looking to like get on that path, get with the people who know how to do it. You alcoholics know how to do it. Sober, that's who I want to hang out with. So thank you for what you do. And you H&I people, thank you. You program people. It seems like you guys are all in the back there. Hey, my hat is off to you. Thank you so much for being here and sticking with it. Our communities need you, and my community needs me. My whole deal out here is to build community, and I've been doing it since I've been home. That's what I'm doing, is building community. And you guys, we need you, man. Step up. Sit all the way down and stay, man, and watch what happens. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, you guys, for being here.